The Fifth Kind. Stay updated on new videos, subscribe and turn on channel notifications by clicking the bell and selecting the all option.
Where these beings go? No. Were they metaphors? No.
He says, I am the powerful one, and it may mean the powerful one, the destroyer. And then he says, walk in front of me, don't put a foot wrong. And within two chapters, he has destroyed two cities, just to make the point. I think that we become what we worship. And so if we worship a God who is violent, we have to justify violence. And once we've justified it, then we will perform it.
Yahweh is one among many colonizers, not as the source of morality.
If we go to the Babylonians, they didn't talk about gods. They talked about Anunnaki, sky people. The Hebrew writers didn't talk about gods. They talked about Elohim, powers, powerful ones.
It's true that the Bible doesn't speak about UFO, because the Bible speaks about identified flying objects.
If you read the Enuma Elish, there are the four winds involved in separating the waters, and you begin to recognize, wait, that's a theme in Genesis as well, separating of waters. And so you've now got a perspective on why you might have a wind maker in the sky that's part of this recovery story. It's part of a pattern that repeats around the world.
If you respect the text, you realize that you are reading about concrete phenomena, possibly technological.
What would you say to a person who comes along and says, but Maro, I think the stories of the Bible are all made up?
This episode of The Fifth Kind is brought to you by Ancient Knowledge Academy. If you enjoy exploring the kind of topics that we explore on The Fifth Kind, on the Paul Wallace Channel, and in my Eden series, then Ancient Knowledge Academy is the learning community for you. A learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. We've been told ancient texts about the gods are just myths. Close encounters and anomalous experiences are just fantasy. And ancient wisdom is just irrelevant. But what if the knowledge of our ancestors is not just a reservoir of information about the past, but a roadmap to a better and bigger human experience? Ancient Knowledge Academy is an opportunity for more intentional community, more immersive learning, and a chance to connect with researchers and truth seekers from all around the world. And I will keep our feet on the ground as we explore these stretching topics. And with every subject that we bring to the courses and modules at the Academy, I will always take us to ancestral wisdom and ancient knowledge, believing that what we have in indigenous story and ancestral narratives are resources not just to understand the past, but to understand ourselves in a truer light and equip ourselves for life in the 21st century. Courses at the Academy will include all new material, audio, video, and written resources, and live face-to-face elements so that we can make this learning journey together and in real time. And the Academy enables me to connect more closely with more people who are motivated to make a paradigm-shifting journey and transform their lives. Are you ready? Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to find out more.
It's my very great pleasure to welcome back to The Fifth Kind a scholar of international renown. For years, he produced the very precise renderings of Hebrew language for interlinear Bible texts for the Edizione San Paolo and was commended for the integrity and accuracy of his work. The precision of his work led him to conclusions about the Bible very similar to my own. It's been a great pleasure getting to know him and collaborating with him. We have a new collaboration in the pipeline. Maro Bellino, welcome back to The Fifth Kind.
Oh, thank you to you. Thank you. It's also my pleasure to be here with you and I want to continue our collaboration because it's very interesting and I think it's very useful for our readers.
I think so. Our viewers on The Fifth Kind really enjoyed our collaboration when we recorded our documentaries together about keywords in the Bible. And we have a new book in the pipeline, which we will talk a little bit about later. You make an appearance in one of my books, The Eden Conspiracy, so my readers know who you are.
Oh,
and I finished this fantastic book just recently, The Gods of the Bible. So I want to begin by asking you about this book. The title gives certain things away, but what I loved about the book is the clarity of the logic, the precision of your analysis, and you have a wonderful sense of humor, which runs all through the book, which is very subtle, but I really enjoyed it. But the title, Gods of the Bible, it's a reference to the many powerful beings who appear in the Hebrew texts. And so I wanted to begin by asking what you think they are. Are these mysterious, powerful beings, the Elohim, are they made up? Were they invented by the writers to make a moral message or a religious message? Or are they memories of a completely different kind of being? What do you think the writers were trying to tell us?
Oh, first of all, I want to apologize with your audience for my English. That is very basic, but I hope to be able to make me understood from them. And so they have to be patient with me.
No problem. You're very clear.
Oh, thank you. First of all, thank you, Paul, for your words. Your words about me and about my book. But for me, the starting point is very simple. When we read the Bible without theological filters, we see that Elohim is a plural term, and that is very, very important. The writers did not invent it. They were recording memories that were common also in other cultures of the ancient world, as you write in your books. And where these beings go? No. Were they metaphors? No. They were described as powerful entities. You always send them the powerful one, I remember, and I hear in your videos. And biblical authors wanted just described these entities as active and very, very concrete. The biblical authors wanted to report encounters and relationship between with them, between humankind and Elohim, just as other peoples did it in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, in Greece, but also in North and South America, in Northern Europe and in Australia too. In every part of the world, we find similar traditions, stories of contact with powerful beings who guided, ruled, or sometimes even oppressed human communities. If later theology has told us that these were spiritual beings, this is not what the Hebrew text says. The text is concrete, direct, and very clear, absolutely. And so we can honestly say that the Bible does not speak of the God of theology, but rather of the governor of this of one people, the family of Jacob, and this governor was Yahweh. And so we can honestly say that the Bible does not speak of the God of theology, but rather of the governor of the people of Israel, a governor who, according to the text, was assigned to them by the commander of the Elohim, known as Elion, as written in Deuteronomy.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I mean, when we read the Yahweh and Elohim stories as if they were stories about God, we have some problems. And the first one you just mentioned, that in the Hebrew language and in the Hebrew canon, there is no word that means God in the way you and I mean. There's no word that means a transcendent, supernatural, ultimate being who's the creator of all things. That word does not exist. The second problem is that the Elohim are plural, and yet it gets translated as God in various places. And the third problem is that the behavior of Yahweh and the other Elohim is very immoral. And so I wanted to ask you, can you talk us through some of the moral problems that arise from reading these as God stories? And I wanted to ask you, how is it that generations of translators have overlooked all these problems and still translated these as if they were God stories?
Oh, this, Paul, this is a very important point. First, there is no word in the biblical Hebrew that corresponds to our word God. This is important to know. The Bible speaks of Elohim, Elion, Yahweh, Milcom, Kamosh, and so on. They were different figures, not an abstract, omnipotent God. Second, Elohim is absolutely plural. For example, in Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Joshua, the Bible clearly says that members of Abraham's own family served different Elohim, and this is absolutely clear, and it is widely documented in my book. Third, the morality. The morality of these beings is often terrible. Yahweh, for example, in the book of Joshua or in the first Samuel, orders extermination. Men, women, children, animals, and these are genocides. Now, if we translate Yahweh as God, then we are forced to justify actions that are unjustifiable. But if we respect the text and recognize that Yahweh is only one of the Elohim, a violent leader among others, then the problem disappears. The difficulty is that for centuries, translators and theologians, of course, have chosen to hide the plural and to interpret these stories through a theological lens turning violent colonizers into the almighty God. So, in this regard, let me give you an example. The Hebrew word Shaddai is always translated as almighty. But in reality, it doesn't mean almighty at all. A much more accurate rendering would be Lord of the Steppe or Lord of the Mountain. We have to know that because the translation almighty is incorrect or maybe intentionally false mistranslation.
Yes. So it's an invented translation when we see it rendered as the Almighty. And there's another theory among scholars that Shaddai might be derived from a word that means the destroyer.
Oh, yes. I agree, because the verbal root Shaddad refers to violence. So El Shaddai could of course, means I am El the violent El.
Yes.
So you, Abraham, have to be attempted my orders because I'm violent.
Yes, that's right. That is, in fact, his introduction to Abraham, isn't it? It's their first conversation. He says, I am the powerful one, and it may mean the powerful one, the destroyer. And then he says, don't put a foot wrong. Walk in front of me. Don't put a foot wrong. And within two chapters, he has destroyed two cities, just to make the point. So it sort of fits with the story, for sure.
Okay.
I think it's interesting. There are two passages that you referred to just now, which are Deuteronomy 32 and Psalm 82, which reveals that Yahweh is a junior Elohim in a council that's presided over by another being called El Elyon. When you were working with Edizione San Paolo and translating those passages, how did you approach those passages, and what was your publisher's approach to these passages that would seem to contradict the theological view they wanted to put forward?
Oh, yes. They translated always Elohim, Elion, Yahweh as one singular spiritual individual. But is a mistake, of course, clearly a mistake, because in Deuteronomy is clear that Elion assigned as a legacy one people, I would say, not one people, not all the Hebrews, but only one family, the family of Jacob, to Yahweh. And this family didn't have a land.
Yes.
But it was moving around on the desert. And so Yahweh had the need to construct a people in order to conquer a land on which they can dwell. But when I was working for Edizioni San Paolo, my job was, and this is important, was to translate word by word without interpretation.
Yes.
For this reason, I insisted that many key terms should be left in Hebrew: Elohim, Ruach, Kavod, and others. Just we said in our videos, in our many videos. But why this? Because when you leave them, you see how they behave in the text. Take Kavod, for example. It is always translated as spiritual glory. But when you read Exodus or Ezekiel, you see that this spiritual glory gets up of the ground, makes a loud noise, produces light, burns skin, it's dangerous, takes people into the sky, and so on. This is not spiritual glory, of course. It behaves like a technology. So instead of inventing theological translations, I preferred to leave the word kavod. The same with ruach, for example, usually translated as a spirit, but it moves like a wind, it comes from a specific direction, it lifts people, it transports them, as in the cases, for example, of Enoch and Elijah. And this is important to know. If you respect the text, you realize that you are reading about concrete phenomena, possibly technological. The context helps us to understand what the authors really wanted to say when he described this situation, this so-called vision. But they were not visions, they were concrete events.
Yes. I love this approach of leaving these vital words untranslated so that the reader can see how they behave in the text. They can see what a ruach does, how a kavod behaves, what a tub does, so on and so forth. And I'm really intrigued by these moments in the Bible that strongly suggest technology. So you mentioned the kavod in Ezekiel, where we have the textures described, the sound of it, the vibrations of it, the feeling of it. Ezekiel talks about going into it, being transported in it. And there are other moments in the Bible too that strongly suggest technology, moments around the Ark of the Covenant, moments around weaponry. Also in Ezekiel, we've got the Keli Mapaso, the Keli Mashato. When you were translating for Edizioni San Paolo, how did the publisher handle those texts? Because for generations, people have been translating those texts believing that these are spiritual stories. Now in the 21st century, we've got other comparisons we can make. We know what a rocket launch sounds like. We know what G-forces feel like. We know what a drone looks like. And we can read these passages and think, all right, this isn't a spiritual encounter. It's a technological encounter. How did your publisher approach that? Was it sufficient just to leave certain words untranslated, or did it raise other issues and other questions?
But when I translated for Edizioni San Paolo, they accept to leave some terms untranslated, just like Elohim, for example, just like Yahweh, for example. That is important to let it untranslated, because it's difficult to know the real meaning of this word. And my collaboration with Edizioni San Paolo finished when I started to speak in public about the real meaning of this term, about what really this term indicates, and about what really Kabod, Ruach, Merkava, Efa, Megillah was really in the Bible because they were really described. And yes. I often says that the Bible, it's true that the Bible doesn't speak about UFO, because the Bible speaks about identified flying object.
Yes, it does.
That are well described, so we don't have any doubt about this. It's clear. It's enough to read the Bible without the lenses of the theologians, of the doctrine, of the without the lenses of the dogmas, for example.
Yes,
it's we. You and I don't want to substitute a dogma with another dogma, but give to the readers, to the audience, the tools to reason, the tools for to reason about what the ancient authors really wanted to say. And
yes.
They described what they saw, but what they really saw, not in a vision, not in dreams.
Yes, and, yes, I agree.
And there's, of course, there has been opposition. But my work is simple.
I was going to ask you about the opposition, that when you first started speaking publicly about these things that you had found in the texts, and started talking about them not from the religious point of view, but simply from the point of view of saying, this is what the writers said they saw, what was the opposition that you experienced? What was the pushback? Did you come under a lot of criticism?
Oh, but of course there has been opposition, but my work is simple. And my answer is this. I say, let's pretend that the Bible tells the truth, and let's translate it literally. That's all. Why I think, of course, is it important? Because if the Bible is telling us about technology and about powerful beings from the past, then we are dealing with our real history, not with theology. And this makes, of course, a big difference, you know. If Yahweh is God, then his violence is divine violence, and it must be worshipped. But if Yahweh is one among many colonizers, then we can understand him as part of human history, not as the source of morality. This is very important, absolutely, because belief in a violent God has justified wars and oppressions for centuries, and also today, as we can see. Returning to the literal text, it frees us from that burden and gives us a more honest reading of our past. This is
yes.
important also because the knowledge of the past helps us to understand the present.
Yes, I completely agree. I think that we become what we worship. And so if we worship a God who is violent, we have to justify violence. And once we've justified it, then we will perform it. If we worship a God who's xenophobic, we have to think in xenophobic ways, and it justifies our own xenophobia. So when we make these equations, the consequences can be very negative and very serious, and we've seen the consequences through history. So I'm completely of one mind with you in this. But what would you say to a person who comes along and says, but Maro, I think the stories of the Bible are all made up. I don't think we should give them any attention. What would be your response to that person?
Sorry, I didn't understand.
What would you say to a person who would say, yes, but I think these stories are all fiction? They're all inventions. They're all made up.
Okay.
We shouldn't give them any attention. How would you answer that?
But I follow every year the work of the Israeli archaeologists who publish their findings. They also publish every year a sort of ranking in which they put the most important finding in relation with what is written in the Bible. And so the findings in the land of Israel are many, many, and many. And so we don't have I don't have doubt about this, because there are many evidences about that confirm the writings of the Bible. So I haven't doubt, and it's enough to open the eyes and to see what the archaeologists find in the Near East.
Yes, that's right. In fact, there have been some really interesting findings just in the last 12 months, in fact, in Jerusalem near Temple Mount. The seal of Jehoiazer was found, which shows that Judaism at the time of this artifact in the 8th century BCE understood the Elohim to be part of a group of beings, among whom were the Elohim, the Tinjir, the Anunnaki, the Apkallu, because that was the design on the seal of the senior Jewish official. And it gives us a glimpse into what Judaism was before it was changed into a story of monotheism. Okay. And it's very interesting to me, because my approach and yours are slightly different, but we've come to the same conclusions. Because my approach often asks, what was this before? Where did this story come from? What was its original form? You come to the text and you say, let's just take this seriously. And let's suppose this is true. What does it tell us? And as we drill into our separate questions, you and I have reached exactly the same conclusions about what these beings were.
And in your books, I read your findings during your journey in Turkey, etc. And so I add other evidences about this the reality of the narratives of the Bible, and so I think that people don't have doubt about the veracity of the writing in the Bible. because yes. The ancient authors wanted to tell to their readers, and so, of course, to us, what they really saw. And we have confirmed also by other peoples.
Yes, that's right.
Assyrians, Babylonians, and so on. And these evidences are in the museums in London, for example, in Paris, for example. And it's enough to see that that evidences and the Bible becomes a real historical book.
That's right. In written form, in carved form, in oral tradition, similar stories exist all around the world. And so the Bible story of an invasion by a sky fleet, the Tzeva Hashemayim, and the division of the lands, such as we find in Deuteronomy 32, Psalm 82, you'll find that in Hawaiian story, you'll find it in the Vedas, you'll find it in Nigerian story, Mesoamerican story, and it's the overlaps of those stories that make me take them very seriously and believe that we're looking at cultural memory that has survived in all these narrative traditions.
Oh, yes, and I read that in your books, and I found it very interesting because all the ancient people narrated the same histories. And it's important, but of course, the fact that at that time there wasn't internet. And so,
yes, that's right.
If they invented, we have to accept that in America and in Australia and in Near East, in Africa, as you write in your books, all they invented the same histories. But it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. Also, only to think that it's impossible, absolutely impossible. All they speaks about the son of the stars. And it's impossible that all the ancient people invented the same history about the son of the stars who came, who descended from the stars and taught to humankind writing, farming, breathing, building, living in an organized society, and so on.
Exactly. They can't all invent the same story coincidentally.
Exactly, coincidentally.
Before I let you ask me some questions, Mauro, I want to ask about what you're doing next. I know you've just completed a book with Eric von Daniken, and I'd love to hear a little bit about that and about what your next plans are.
Oh, my future projects. First of all, Paul, I continue to work with you, with you, on our joint project, videos and book, which I find very important because they bring our works, bring together two different, as you said before, different perspectives that converge in many points. I am also preparing new videos and books, of course, where I will continue to focus on these key Hebrew terms that change everything when they are read literally. And of course, I continue to study and to share my research with readers in Italy and abroad, but I agree to work with you because it's for me very, very important. And people can follow my work through my official YouTube channel, through my website maurobiglino.com, that is also translated in English, not by me, of course, by a professional translator, through my English books published by Tutti Edizioni, and soon also through our new book, Project Together, which I hope will open even more doors for readers who want to approach the Bible with absolutely respect for its original ancient authors. That's absolutely important.
Agreed. Agreed. I'm looking forward to that project hugely. We're aiming for early 2026 to have that book launched and the title to be announced.
Okay. Dear Paul, we have been working together for quite some time now, producing and discussing many videos. And we both know this collaboration will continue. I want to underline this fact. What I find really remarkable is that the results of our research align, as you said before, as you often says, by about 90 to 95%.
That's right.
What makes this even more extraordinary is that such a high level of agreement comes from two quite different approaches to study. Considering your career as a clergyman, archdeacon in the Anglican Church, theologian, lecturer in theology, I think it will be very valuable for our audience if you could explain the method of study you apply in your research.
Certainly. Well, my route into this territory has been through hermeneutics. And for 15 years, I provided in-service training to pastors in hermeneutics, which is the principles of interpretation. And so my aim was to equip people whose job was to interpret texts and then preach them. And so the sort of tools that I would be teaching would include form analysis, where we have to work out what kind of literature is this that we're reading and find clues in the text to answer that question. And then source analysis that asks the question, where has this text come from? Is it in its original form? How does it differ from the original? What is the agenda of the writer who's produced the current form? And then always going to the linguistic questions as well, which is where you and I really overlap, asking what do the words really mean? And I find it very helpful to go to the root meanings of the keywords every time, because if you go to the etymological meaning, to the most basic meaning of the word, it can be a way of peeling back centuries of assumptions and religious interpretations to get a more basic idea of what that sentence may have originally meant. And so to do this, we would use tools from the best scholars of New Testament Greek and Hebrew. And so I would train my pastors to use interlinear texts and then to go from the very precise renderings of the words to the best lexicons. So for New Testament Greek, we would go to the Bauer, Arndt, Gingrich, and Danker. And a great thing about a lexicon like that is it shows you all the different ways in which this word is used, the main usages down to the minor usages. And as you look through them, you can see what the component parts mean and the different ways the word works. You could do the same with Hebrew. I would send my scholars to the Brown Driver Briggs for Hebrew, and we would apply those same questions. So these were the kinds of tools I was working with as a preacher for a long time, and then I taught it to other preachers. But what happened was I started applying those disciplines to texts where there were problems, texts that didn't seem to fit the familiar religious stories. And I found when I approached these problems as translation questions, another story emerged. So if I went to an Elohim story where Elohim is behaving in the plural, if instead of translating it as God, I translate it as powerful ones or powers, which is the most fundamental reading of the word, I found that the story would change, but not in a random way. And this is where the source analysis came in, because the Elohim stories would change in such a way that I could immediately recognize I was reading another version of a Babylonian story. I was reading a summary form of a Sumerian story. And so another tool that became very important to me was taking the Bible out of its bubble and reading it within the family of literature to which it belongs. So to read the Hebrew stories alongside the Sumerian, Babylonian, Akkadian, and Assyrian stories. And as soon as you read it in that context, you understand the Hebrew story differently. You recognize what kind of story it is. You can recognize a story that's been based on someone else's story of sky people. These parallels become very clear. And similarly, in the New Testament, if you take it out of its bubble, put it in its context, read it alongside other Greco-Roman literature, you will suddenly start recognizing the tropes. Ah, here is a missing body story. Here is a resurrection story. Here is a virgin birth story. And once you've read the stories in context, you begin to understand. This is the form question. What form of story you're reading? You begin to recognize the sources of those stories. And for me, doing that work was like taking the red pill in the movie The Matrix. It opened up a whole new world to me. And so it sent me then to read the stories of other cultures and the stories that came out of the source cultures. And again, I would approach those in a similar way. So if I'm reading a Babylonian text like the Enuma Elish or the Artaxerxes tablets or the Epic of Gilgamesh, I have to have a number of translations in front of me to see how they have dealt with the translation work. And if you have a number of translations, it gives you an idea of what are the questions around this word? What are the possibilities around this word? And having the number gives you a sort of 360-degree view of how that word works. I also find it helpful to go back to the earliest translations of the Mesopotamian cuneiforms, for instance, because often in the earliest translations, what you have is someone who's trying to render what they have found without trying to make it make sense. And I find often that as we go through the history of translations, we find the sort of theological aspect comes in. People want the text to make sense. They want the reader to understand it. And you get a bit more interpretation rather than brute translation. So I always have a number of translations, but I often favor the oldest ones to try and get the most primitive handle on the texts. So that's been my general approach to the stories and to getting beyond the religious readings and back to a more primitive, basic, original understanding of what was in the text.
Okay, but I know that you know also the stories of African people, for example. I read it in your books, and it's very interesting to see this relationship between the stories all around the world.
It is.
You have this kind of experience that I find very interesting.
It impacts the translation questions because you mentioned the word ruach, for instance, and how it appears to be a wind or wind maker when you look at how it behaves in the text. If you read the Enuma Elish, or if you listen to traditional Filipino story, you will hear echoes of this idea of winds doing the work of terraforming. If you read the Enuma Elish, there are the four winds involved in separating the waters, and you begin to recognize, wait, that's a theme in Genesis as well, separating of waters. And so you've now got a perspective on why you might have a wind maker in the sky that's part of this recovery story. It's part of a pattern that repeats around the world. So you take that primitive reading more seriously when you see that it lines up with other ancestral story.
Yes, and that is very, very important because it makes sense. Instead, I think the explanation of the theologian doesn't make sense in regard to what is written in the Bible, because often they speak without attention of what is written in the Bible, but explaining their theories, their elaborations.
Yes.
Without reading
right.
the text, because I think in order to understand the real meaning of many terms of the Bible, is absolutely important to pay attention to the context.
Yes,
because it's the context that helps us to understand what Kavod, Ruach, Olam, and others terms really really mean. So we have to contextualize these terms, and they become clear. Absolutely. I have another question for you.
Okay.
I have read your books, and your book, The Hidden Enigma, which is part of the Hidden series, covers a wide range of fascinating subjects, many of them stemming from the journey of research you carried out in the regions where the biblical Eden might be located. Among the many themes you address, you speak about the so-called doorways, emphasizing that they can be found all over the world. For example, at page 18, you write, "But I have found that once I begin to approach ancient glyphs and carvings and text on the basis of root meanings of their keywords, ideas, of contact with other civilizations become impossible to avoid. In the chapters ahead, I will show you what I mean. And you show it very, very well. It's very interesting to read your book. The other question I want to ask you about the hidden enigma concerns the recurring depictions found almost everywhere around the world of deities holding two mysterious objects, one that looks like a bag and another in the shape of a pine cone. At pages 108, you write that your guide during your journey says you, of course, people want to know what is in that handbag. This, Paul, is a very particular example of it. Come and look closely, because, as you will see, this one shows us some extra detail. And so it's very, very curious when the reader arrives to that pages. I've come across many different interpretations of these symbols, but your personal research carried out in those extraordinary locations you describe has led you to propose a very concrete, finally, a very concrete explanation. Could you tell us something about it?
Certainly. And you're quite right. We see this pairing of symbols in various places around the world. The pine cone, or sometimes it's a cypress leaf, and then the handbag, or sometimes it's a bucket, sometimes it's a bowl. But it's carried, and then there's something that's going to be done with this device, whatever it really was. And the pose is the same. In carvings from different cultures around the world. So people have been very intrigued by this. What were these objects? What were they used for? And that moment that you mentioned where my guide is saying there's a bit more detail in this one, that was in Tamil Nadu in India, where Praveen Mohan was pointing out a particular version of it where you can see what's in the satchel. And so, of course, we want to solve this mystery. So we look in the satchel, but we find another mystery, because we find two vials inside the satchel. But what that tells us is that what's being carried here is something that is poured. So it's either a liquid or an emulsion. It could be seeds. It could be powder. But it is something that is poured. And then there's this applicator that's going to be used here. People have many theories about what they mean. People have, because of the context, associated these devices with an upgrade to the human experience. So there seems to be a story of advanced beings helping humanity and advancing us through these tools. And perhaps they became symbolic of every advantage that our contact with an advanced civilization brought to us, or visitors from another planet gave us in the deep past. So it can symbolize a lot of different things, but you're right. In the Eden Enigma, I think it actually comes down to something very concrete, very specific, and a bit like comparing the Ruach story with other recovery stories around the world. I find when we put the pictorial stories together around the world, that's when the detail becomes clear. So in the Eden Enigma, we go to Armenia, to Yerevan, to the Fortress of Blood at Ebuni, and we can find paintings showing this activity. We can go down into modern-day Iran and look at the reliefs from the palace of Ashurnasirpal, the second Bronze Age ruler, and the art produced for him is very, very exquisite. So there's a lot of detail in it. And when we compare these images along with images I saw in Turkey, in the sites of the Bronze Age Biennale, we can put picture alongside picture, and all of a sudden it's very clear that this story relates to the deep story of the region. The deep story of Anatolia is to do with the invention of agricultural science.
Oh, yes.
And the reboot of the human story. So whether you're listening to the biblical story of Noah in Genesis, you'll be hearing about Ararat, where Noah's boat landed and humanity was rebooted. Or if you're looking at the oldest map in the world, a Babylonian map that's about 3,500 years old, it will point to Ararat and say Zusudra's boat landed here and there was a rebooting of civilization. Go to Armenia and they'll say the first ever vineyard was planted here. Well, that's what Genesis says as well. If you read the 5th century history of the Armenian people by Moses Koronatsi, he will talk about the rebooting of humanity through the bloodline of Haik, who was a descendant of Noah. If you go to the 1200s and listen to the stories of the Aesir, the Norse gods, by Snorri Sturluson, he talks about advanced culture and advanced agricultural science coming from Anatolia, from ancient Armenia, into Northern Europe, into Scandinavia. So you've got all these vectors pointing to Anatolia and saying the reboot of agriculture happened here, the reboot of humanity happened here. So those deep stories all imply that there was some kind of catastrophe that we're recovering from. If you go into Iran, the catastrophe is described as a great and terrible winter. So this is in the story of Jamshid Yimah and Ahura Mazda. Okay. You listen to the Noah story, the disaster is a flood. The Zusudra story, the disaster is a flood. Listen to Greek story, there are sky fires in that story. And I think these are all cultural memories of the Younger Dryas Cold period. That was the last sort of global catastrophe from which we had to recover. And essential to that recovery was the recovery of agriculture. So that's the deep story of the region. Now we're looking at these carvings, and we notice that there are plants that are not thriving in the wild. They are growing in greenhouse-like, laboratory-like conditions. They're an unusual shape, implying that there is artificial light source around them. And here are these beings with the handbag and the pine cone.
Eden.
Yes, Eden. That's right. Exactly.
A fenced garden.
In the safe enclosed zone, that's right.
Okay.
And you can see what they're doing. They are hand pollinating these plants. And that's what's in all the pictures. That is what they're doing to these plants. They've got something in here. They've got the applicator here. They're hand pollinating. They're cross pollinating. Once again, if you ask the question, why would that be necessary? It's only necessary if you can't get your crops to grow, if you're having to recover from a series of failed harvests. You cross-pollinate if you have to bring plants in and create new strains that can survive in the new environment. You hand-pollinate if you don't have the bees or the insects to do it naturally. It implies a prior problem, a prior catastrophe. So you put all those stories together, and the story is that advanced beings showed up. And according to the Biennale story, they arrived in flying shields or flying discs. And then they worked alongside human beings doing hand pollination, doing cross-pollination to create strains of plants that will survive in the new ecological condition and thrive, become cultivatable, recreate farming so that once again you can become settled communities and specialized societies and get back into megalithic building and become a civilization again. And so this symbol is really the beginning of civilization. The hand pollination is the beginning of the relaunch of humanity. And I think that's the memory that belongs to that pairing of symbols.
But now also today in China, for example, they, in many situations, use the hand pollination. Today.
Yes.
So I love so much your concrete description of these symbols. I love so much. When I found it in the Eden Enigma, I was happy for that, because it relates with all the Bible that is substantially only a concrete book.
Yes.
And it's, sorry.
It's sad that knowledge got lost, that we forgot what these items were, because by the time you get to the Bronze Age and later, these items are understood as religious items with no real practical function. And they were used in ceremonies of ritual cleansing. And so the original concrete use had, even by that point, been forgotten.
Yes, absolutely. Because the younger Dryas divided the story, and after it, maybe came from the sky these powerful ones who taught the humankind to restart a path of civilization. I have another question, the last one. This is important because many of our friends ask me what I think about God. That is the problem of the problems, of course. And knowing your life story, I am certain that they will be eager to hear your view as well. Based on your studies and the conclusions you have reached through your research, what is your idea of God? Would you share it with us? But just a moment before we close, I'd love also to hear what future projects you have and how viewers can continue following your journey.
Certainly.
That is very, very interesting in your book.
I'll answer that first. So the next in the Eden series will be our collaboration. I'll have a title in English that will tie it in, and you'll have a title in Italian that will tie it in with your books. So that's the next written project. And if you want to stay up to date on that, then keep up to date with me on paulanthonywallace.com. I'm also starting an immersive learning community at ancientknowledgeacademy.com. And so we'll be doing courses through that really range across all the subjects that we've talked about on The Fifth Kind and on the Paul Wallace Channel. And it enables me to get into closer conversation with more people so that it's real interactive learning together. So that's ancientknowledgeacademy.com. And we'll still be on YouTube as Fifth Kind and as the Paul Wallace Channel. And people ask me this question that you've just answered, that you've just asked me, Mara, all the time. What do I believe now about God? Because I came from a very evangelical Christian faith. How has my idea of God changed? And, you know, sometimes I avoid using the word God because I think the associations people have with it can be very negative. It's been used in a very manipulative way sometimes to try and control populations and to give power to institutions and individuals and kings and princes and popes, and it's not always been a positive story.
Absolutely.
But I think I do still use the word God when I'm thinking about the source of the cosmos. And this is a difference, really, between the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, and the New Testament. We said earlier, there is no word that means God in that sense in the Hebrew canon, but there is in the New Testament, and it's the Greek word theos. And there's a moment in the New Testament when the Apostle Paul has to tell his audience what he means by the word theos. So when we read the Gospels, this is the word Jesus uses, theos. And he addresses Theos as Pater, Father, and speaks to Theos as Abba, Daddy, or Sir. Paul is now speaking to this audience in Athens, and he says, by Theos I mean the source of the cosmos and everything in it, that in which we all live and move and have our being, of which we are all offspring. And when he defines theos that way, it's a pretty good explanation of the Greek understanding of the word theos. And what I like about it is, first of all, there's no separation in that vision. We are all expressions of the source. We are all emanations of the source. My intelligence is a participation in something that's a property of the cosmos. My consciousness is a participation in something that's a property of the cosmos. I am intimately connected with the source and the source with me. We're intimately connected with each other. And I love that vision because there's no separation. There's no separation anxiety. I don't have to claw my way back into God's presence because I'm already in God's presence. I like it because it's a very cosmic view that is almost... it's almost a non-religious description of God, which
okay,
I like.
Okay.
And so I don't, when I use the word God, I'm not thinking of a being or a person or an entity. I'm not thinking of the ultimate king or a puppet master. I'm not thinking of the Almighty, which, as you mentioned, is an invented translation anyway. I'm really thinking about the source of the cosmos. And I think there's no way to describe the source of all things in a way that isn't mind-bending, mind-boggling. And I find God is the only word big enough really to think about the source in that way. And I certainly don't use the word God for anything less than that. I think when we tell the stories of ancient cultures, whenever we use the word God, we are distorting that other culture's story because they didn't use that word. So, you know, the Bayanili people in Bronze Age, what is now Turkey, they didn't talk about gods. They talked about Tinjir. If we go to the Babylonians, they didn't talk about gods. They talked about Anunnaki, sky people. The Hebrew writers didn't talk about gods. They talked about Elohim, powers, powerful ones. And so, again, I think it's better to go back to the more primitive words and say what we mean. And even if we're talking about current reality, sometimes it's better to avoid the word God and say what we mean. If we mean the source, let's say source. If we mean intelligence, let's say intelligence. If we mean the cosmos, let's say that. And sometimes it's better to leave the word God to one side because it can be so confusing.
Okay, a precise answer. But I know you have been studying also Plato for many years. And you often quote Plato in your videos because it could be the source of this idea of the unity of the universe.
I think Plato, I love how he talks about God and the source, and he talks about it in different ways. And there's a section of, I think it's his book Phaedo, where he argues that before the material cosmos was consciousness. and to use more modern language, that if you keep asking the question, what came before, you will reach a point where before doesn't mean before anymore, which is what Einstein said, that time had a beginning. And when you get back to the point where time has a beginning, when you look around, what do you see? Plato would say you would see consciousness. And it's from this that everything comes. Again, it's a mind-bending idea, but I find it very powerful because I think that vision of all of us being an emanation of the same source is empowering. It's not frightening. It encourages us to see the purpose of this life as being to have experiences, to enrich the whole with the experiences we have and the things we learn. It's not about tiptoeing around trying to please an almighty king. That's a very demeaning way of thinking about life. Whereas if I'm an emanation of the source, here to experience the cosmos, then that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to go at that with all the enthusiasm and courage that I can. Mauro, thank you so much for our conversation today. We could talk for far longer, and we're going to have many more conversations, particularly as we put our book together. But for the time being, on behalf of all our viewers, I want to say thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure once again.
Oh, I want to send my greetings and sincere thanks to you, of course, and to all listeners. And I say bye and see you again. And me and you will continue to work together.
Certo. Arrivederci. Certo.
Ciao.
Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind. If you enjoy our documentaries and interviews, sign up for Ancient Knowledge Academy, a learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Our courses will include navigating unexpected shifts and transitions in our lives, reframing faith and recovering from fundamentalism, living with close encounters and unexplained phenomena, learning to read the ancient cuneiforms of Sumer, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria, and reading them alongside the Bible, a virtual tour of Van Province in Turkey, digging into stories told by Bronze Age artifacts that take us into the world of the last ice age more than 10,000 years ago, 7 workshops in mindfulness and consciousness to heighten your cognitive powers, your intuitive capacity, and your capacity to manage stress, finding the juicy bits in the works of Plato, and how to find and talk about paleo contact in the Bible. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to find out more.